Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
I particularly am excited to see a number of our industrial collaborators here today. That's a large part of why we hold this activity. We want to see collaborations spawned and fostered, and it's why we hold these meetings, and we hope to see more of those collaborations happening, and we want to see all of you interacting with us more. So with that, I'm going to turn the program over to Frank and let him introduce the first speaker. Frank.
My name is Frank Doyle. I'm the Associate Dean for Research in the College of Engineering, and it's my very great privilege to be able to introduce our plenary speaker this morning, Dr. Leroy Hood from the Institute for Systems Biology in Seattle. Lee got his training in originally in an MD at Johns Hopkins University, followed by a PhD in biochemistry at Caltech. He then started his academic career at Caltech, where he and his colleagues pioneered, among other things, the DNA sequencer. And we all know how this revolutionized genomics and led to the rapid automated sequencing of DNA and how critically enabling this was for, among other things, the Human Genome Project. More recently, in 2000, Lee moved to co-founded the Institute for Systems Biology in Seattle to continue the pioneering approaches he's taken to biology and medicine. For his work on the DNA sequencer, Dr. Hood was awarded the 2002 Kyoto Prize in Advanced Technology, as well as the 2003 Lemelson MIT Prize for Innovation and Invention. And this is one of the reasons we're really thrilled to have Lee as our plenary speaker, as he truly appreciates that interface between technology and fundamentals, particularly in biology. Lee's co-authored more than 600 peer-reviewed papers, received 14 patents, and has co-authored textbooks in biochemistry, immunology, molecular biology, and genetics, as well as a textbook he's wrapping up now on systems biology. He's a member of both the National Academy of Science and the Institute of Medicine. Dr. Hood's played a founding role in founding more than 14 biotech companies, including Amgen, Applied Biosystems, Systemics, Darwin, and Rosetta. So he's currently pioneering systems medicine and the systems approach to disease, and we're thrilled to welcome him as our plenary speaker here for Bioengineering Insights. Dr. Hood.
I'll argue that P4 medicine isn't an incremental evolutionary change from what's gone before. I'll argue it's a new creature that's really going to transform how we think about medicine and move it into a realm of enormous information dimensionality. And what I'd like to do, in addition to talking about the science, is talk just a little bit about the sociology of science and how all of these things have come about. And in that regard, let me talk about some of the changes that I've seen over my 40-some years of doing science, and had the chance to participate in four paradigm changes. So the first has to do with, in a sense, bringing engineering to biology. But I think the really important aspect of it was to bring high-throughput measurements to biology. And as you heard, I did that at the early days of Caltech. One of the instruments we developed, the automated sequencer, got me invited to the first meeting, actually chaired by Bob Sinsheimer, who's in the audience today, when he was Chancellor at Santa Cruz, to consider this whole question of the Human Genome Project. And that meeting, in turn, got me excited about the potential of the Human Genome Project for really transforming biology. In developing the sequencer, it really became obvious that we had to bring to biology scientists of all disciplines. And I tried to argue at Caltech this would be a really terrific thing to do, that is to set up a cross-disciplinary biology department. But biology at Caltech didn't seem to be interested, so Bill Gates gave us the opportunity at the University of Washington to set up the first truly cross-disciplinary department, and it had absolutely transformational effect on biology that we can talk about at some other time. And of course, from that, it was natural to move into systems biology and thinking about a holistic rather than an atomistic view of biology and, as you'll hear later today, medicine. From that really came the systems thinking about disease, systems thinking about medicine, and this thing we've called P4 medicine. And I would make about my experiences just three different points. Number one, each of those revolutions was really controversial at its inception. And in fact, I remember when we started the Institute for Systems Biology in 2000 in Seattle, that as I went around the country talking about this, an overwhelming response I got from the biologists who were mature and thoughtful was, this is hype, it's trivial, there isn't really anything to it. So it was very interesting to see a National Academy report come out very recently on the new biology. And the new biology described in every way the things we'd written about systems biology 10 years ago. So the hysteresis is 5 to 10 years for people to get these kinds of things. A second point I would make is that each of these things fundamentally changed how we looked about biology, and I think you'll get some sense of this as we go through the lecture. But what was most interesting is to really achieve each of these, we had to create new institutions. So we started Applied Biosystems to really get the high-throughput biology going. We had to create new institutes at NIH to get the Genome Project going. We created a new department at the University of Washington for cross-disciplinary biology, and of course, a new institute, the first of its type on systems biology. And of course, one of the really interesting questions is, what are we going to need to do to push P-forward medicine forward? And I'm going to talk about that again at the very end of my lecture. What underlies this contemporary view of biology, systems view of biology, of course, is the idea that it basically is an informational science. And there are really two fundamental types of information. There's the digital information that's embedded in the genome, and there's the environmental information that comes from outside the genome. And it's the interaction of these two types of information that through biological networks that ultimately leads to their integrated manifestation as phenotype of the organism. And of course, there are two informational structures that are essential for dealing with information. And one, as I've said, are these biological networks. And biological networks in their entirety have never been described. And here I've listed four different views of an integrated biological network, so we only see a part of the dimensionality of the total network, and there are probably other aspects that aren't even included there. So these networks capture information, and they transmit it, they integrate it, modulate it, and then they pass it off to the second type of structure, which is our simple and complex molecular machines, and there that is the machinery that actually executes the functions of life. And the integration of networks with machines is, I think, one of the fascinating grand challenges of contemporary systems biology. But what I will really emphasize is that in the collision between digital information and environmental information, their output is manifest as dynamical biological network behavior. Hence, if you can infer and analyze the dynamics of the networks, you can begin to disambiguate genomic contributions from environmental contributions. And once again, we're just beginning to learn how to do that. This is a complicated network, probably the most detailed network that's been worked out for an aspect of development in the sea urchin by Eric Davidson at Caltech. And the important point about this network is once you have this enormously detailed wiring diagram, it presents you with the opportunity of modifying that diagram in a way that creates new and predictable phenotypes. And Eric has done this in several occasions. And of course, in medicine, what we'd like to be able to do is to take a disease-perturbed network and modify its behavior with drugs so as to make it behave in a more normal fashion, or at least to abrogate its more deleterious effects. What is true about biological information is it's multiscalar. We go from DNA and RNA and protein and interactions all the way up to tissues and individuals and populations and ecology. And the important point to realize is the original output of digital information at the DNA level is modified by the environment at each successive level of this information hierarchy. Hence, if you're to truly understand systems approaches, you must integrate the different levels of information up to the level of where the phenotype is manifest. Say if you're interested in the in cell division, you have to capture the information at least up to the level of the cells. And then you have to be able to integrate these different types of information so as to capture the environmental inputs and understand how they modulate the original digital core. And that kind of integration of different levels of information, again, is really one of the grand challenges in systems biology. So let me tell you how we view what we view as some of the most central features of systems biology and frankly, more recently, systems medicine. So number one, you always want to be able to do as comprehensive or as global analyses as possible. All genes, all the messages, all microRNAs. We can do global genomic studies. We can't yet do global proteomic and metabolomic studies for just technical reasons, but we're rapidly moving in that direction. Number two, you have to carry out this type of integration of different data types, and we've already talked about why that is important. Number three, you have to remember that biological networks are dynamical, and they change in two dimensions. They change in the nature of the proteins or molecular informational entities that constitute the nodal points in the network, and they change in the architecture of the network. So we can measure the nodal point changes far more easily than we can measure architectural changes, but both obviously are important in understanding the dynamics. It's also important to remember that systems biology is basically hypothesis-driven. The idea is for a given system, you formulate a model that encompasses pre-existing data, you create hypotheses to test it, you do experimental perturbations of the system, you integrate the data then back into the model in an iterative fashion until you bring, hopefully, theory and experiment into apposition one to another. Another aspect of systems biology is, of course, the creation of models that are both predictive and, in the case of medicine, actionable. Means the model will tell a physician something that they can do that can really help the patient. And, of course, the models can be descriptive, they can be graphical, or they can be mathematical, and models at any of those levels can be enormously informative, depending on the granularity of information you need to solve your particular problem. And, of course, the final aspect is we really have to push all of our measurements more and more to being quantitative if we are to ever begin to understand the subtle mechanistic details of these systems and so forth. So systems medicine is really predicated on the idea that biological networks, one or more of them, can become disease-perturbed either by genetic mutations and or environmental perturbations that alters the envelope of information they express in a dynamic manner. And it's that altered envelope of information, obviously, that encodes the disease phenotype, but as well, it gives you new approaches to thinking both about diagnosis, about therapy, and ultimately about prevention. We'll talk about each of these in a general way. Let me give you the best studied example of a systems approach to a disease now, one that we've been working on together with George Carlson at the McLaughlin Institute in Great Falls, Montana, now for almost 6 years. And the idea there was that we could study prion infections in mice because we could initiate the infection time and then take multiple sample points across the onset of the disease. The disease manifests itself in the brain, so we did the analysis by doing complete transcriptome analyses of infected mice and their normal litter counterparts. And we subtracted these two analyses so we could look just at the genes that actually changed. And we've actually looked, as you'll see in a moment, at 8 different inbred strains of mice. And actually now we have probably close to 70 million data points, and we've had to develop new statistical methods for being able to integrate effectively different data from different types of mice together, as well as making the really important point that in all systems biology studies, high throughput analyses, the overwhelming problem is signal to noise. And anytime you study data at a one-dimensional manner, you're never going to be able to deal with the signal to noise. And perhaps the best example of this are the multiplicity of incredibly expensive genome-wide polymorphism studies that have been carried out in many different kinds of disease states, which end up giving you a ranked list of genes that may be associated with the disorder, but probably 98% of the genes on those lists have nothing to do in a primary sense with the disorder. And how you disambiguate which are relevant genes from non-relevant genes is really key. And I think there are two ways that you can do it. And the most important way is to integrate different levels of information. I'll show you that in just a moment. But the second way is to use really clever biology. So we actually studied 8 different strains of mice, 5 different inbred strains, mice that underexpress or overexpress prion protein, a major element in this disease, and then finally a strain that's a double knockout for the disease. And let me just tell you, for example, how we can use biology to subtract away noise. In the mice that are a double knockout for the disease, no disease is ever manifest. So if you carry through the experimental manipulations and the brains of those mice change, all of those changes are irrelevant to the core of what the disease is about. And in fact, we were able to use various subtractive analyses to start out with a list of 7,400 genes that changed in one or more of these 8 inbred strains and reduced it down to a core of 333 genes, which we think encoded the real essence of this prion response, which is basically a neurological degeneration response. And I list here just a bunch of the subtractive analyses that we did. And I'm not going to go through these. For any biologists, I'd be glad to talk about them in detail. But that's why one of the things the engineers must understand is you'll never get very far in biology unless you understand the biology you're working on in a deep sense, because you're not going to do it just with measurements, and you're not going to do it with statistics. You really have to bring the biology to bear as well. We mapped then the 333 genes, core genes, into 4 major networks that were reflected by histopathologic studies of this disease. One is prion replication and accumulation. The other is activation of glial cells. And then 2 others have to do with the degeneration of nerve cells and ultimately their death. And we were in this process able to put together these 5 different types of information, from the molecular information to the network information to the histopathology to the accumulation of the disease-causing prion protein. and ultimately the clinical signs. And here's an example at 6 weeks of one of the major networks, prion accumulation and replication. Yellow means the transcripts and the normal and controls are exactly the same. Red means the diseased animals have had an elevation. And the bars around little subnetworks there indicate modular activities within the overall scope of prion replication and accumulation. In the lower right-hand box is staining for the infectious prion protein, and you see at 6 weeks essentially none. And in the upper left-hand box is an indication of clinical signs and so forth. So at 10 weeks, you begin to see a real onset of infectious prion protein. There is also activation of some of the glial cells by that time, but no clinical signs whatsoever. At 14 weeks, you can begin to see really quite extensive changes, a lot of prion protein. And let me just say, 14 weeks is about 4 weeks before you see the first clinical signs whatsoever. And then finally, at 20 weeks, which is just a week or two before the animals are exsanguinated, you see the maximum response and the maximum infectious prion protein in sagittal sections of the brain, and you begin to see real clinical signs here. So what can we take from a view of this network and three other networks that were analyzed in a simple fashion? I think there are five take-home lessons. Two-thirds of the genes mapped into these four networks that we knew about, and they beautifully explained all of the dynamic pathophysiology of the disease. In fact, we had a neuropathologist say this, who studied this for 25 years, prion disease in mice, say this is the first time he ever had a totally integrated view of how everything worked in terms of these networks and everything. The remaining third of the genes encoded novel pathways in the disease that no one had known about before, so they open up new aspects of study. And this is why global studies are so important. If you only study the things you know about, you're going to miss a lot of other important things. This is, in a sense, these are the dark genes of prion disease. It is clear when we look at these networks, particularly at the early stages, that there are interesting hypotheses we could put forward for reengineering the network so as to possibly abrogate the disease. So this is the beginning of thinking about new strategies for drug target identification. And finally, I'm going to talk in some detail about how we can take a systems approach to diagnosis. How do you get the very, very close time points of the dynamics of these networks and how they're changing? What we've done is to use neurospheres. These are embryonic nerve stem cells. And we're able, A, to grow them and let them differentiate to each of the major three major cell types in the brain. B, we're able to infect them. And then we can interrogate the dynamics of that infectious process as frequently as we wish to see what exactly is happening. Now, when you do things in tissue culture, you lose some of the control that comes from association with other cells. But we're finding we're learning an enormous amount about the very earliest stages of prion disease. And again, getting back to what we might do about drug target discovery for abrogation of these responses is one of the key features we're interested in here. So what is true is for the last 5 or 6 years, we've spent billions of dollars on blood biomarkers, and we have almost nothing to show for it. And the reason for that is it's very easy to see, to take 10 men with prostate cancer and use proteomics in the blood to identify proteins that distinguish them from 10 normal counterparts. But when you attempt to take those proteins and look at them in diverse clinical situations, they do all sorts of things that are unexpected because almost all the proteins are synthesized in multiple organs, and if they change, you don't know the organ of locus. And that failure is the basis for our thinking about a systems approach to blood diagnostics. And it actually has two different components to it. number one, we can look at networks at different stages. At 12 weeks, that's 6 weeks before clinical signs, we can ask, what about the transcripts that have changed? Do they encode proteins secreted into the blood, and do they reflect in the blood that altered state? And the answer to that is yes, that works absolutely beautifully. But just looking at key nodal points and their protein expression in the blood is insufficient for the reason I just gave. They can change, and if they're synthesized in multiple organs, we're never certain about the locus of the origin of that change. So the second thing that we've used then is the idea of organ-specific transcripts. They can be identified by deep comparative transcriptome analysis from, say, the brain that you're interested again in against 40 other major organs in the mouse or in the human. And you can ask which transcripts are either expressed uniquely in the brain or predominantly in the brain. And those are relatively straightforward things to do. And then once you've identified those transcripts, you can ask, do they encode proteins that are secreted into the blood? And the answer is many of them do. We've demonstrated this. And of course, those proteins then constitute a brain-specific fingerprint where each protein recognizes the behavior of its cognate biological network. If that's unchanged, then its level of expression will be unchanged. If disease perturbs that network, it modifies the expression of that protein. Because different diseases perturb different combinations of networks, you can get unique concentration fingerprints from the brain-specific blood proteins that are characteristic of health and of disease, and indeed define each of the different types of disease. And the approach that we've taken to the discovery and semi-validation of these proteins is mass spectrometry, and it's an approach developed by Rudy Ebersole, a colleague of mine at ISB and the ETH, that uses MRM, mass spectrometry, multiple reaction monitoring. And basically, you use the triple quad as a purification device, taking in the first quad a triptych mixture. You can isolate a single peptide fragment, you can fragment it in the second quad, and you can measure the fragments in the third quad. And you can define fragments that are uniquely characteristic of each triptych peptide for a particular protein you'd like to define, and you can make isotopic labels of those, and you can actually identify down to the low attomole level these proteins in complex mixtures like the blood if you first do a reduction in complexity of the blood. And I'm not even going to talk about that. That's another whole world that we have to deal with. But this gives us the ability to analyze 1 to 200 proteins per hour at the low attomole level. It gives us and we've just recently got a stimulus grant to make the MRM peptide assays for every single human protein. So in the next 2 to 3 years, we hope to have complete assays for virtually all of the human proteins. And of course, the ones we're putting at the front of the list are the ones that are organ-specific for organs we're interested in analyzing. So let me tell you about a recent analysis and how powerful this systems view of disease really is. So we identified 106 brain-specific blood proteins that are present in databases and have been analyzed in the blood already. So we know we can detect those 106, okay? We showed that 45 of those 106 are present in one or more of those four networks for prion disease that I talked about. And we analyzed those 45 using mass spectrometry and demonstrated that a third of them, 15 of them, are manifest at levels increased 8 to 30-fold 4 weeks before any clinical signs have come up in this disease in the blood. And we've actually taken one protein and we've done its analysis all the way across to the dynamic transition from health to disease, and we've demonstrated that one protein shows up at exactly the time its network first becomes disease perturbed. So the really interesting idea then is that A, the four networks you can see listed above come in successively in a time span. And of the 15 proteins in red there, you can see each represents a subset of those networks. And we've already shown that the earliest protein expressed is the one that is encoded by the prion accumulation and replication network. So we're in the process of testing now whether the other 14 come in at exactly these differential time points, and we have preliminary data to suggest that they are. So what this means is from the blood, you can follow enormously effective the dynamics of the networks and their progressive recruitment of interacting networks. So it makes it possible to do things in humans that we couldn't even think about doing before, because in humans there is enormous orthology between organ-specific proteins in the three organs we're looking at in some detail, human to mouse. So actually, about 70% of the mouse proteins we're making assays for, those same assays will work for the human proteins in the brain. So I would argue, from the disease diagnostic point of view, there are four things these organ-specific proteins can do. One is early detection. You've already seen an example of that. A second is stratification of the disease. That is, we know that, for example, prostate cancer isn't one disease. It's at a minimum two diseases and probably more. 85% of prostate cancers aren't going to hurt the patient, shouldn't be treated at all. 15% are really malignant. If we could do just that stratification, we could save the U.S. health system about somewhere between $16 billion and $20 billion a year for complications that people that shouldn't be treated have. Third thing we can do, and I've already demonstrated the beginnings of showing that, is given a particular type of disease, we can follow disease progression. And of course, we'll be able to follow therapy very, very nicely. And in fact, we recently have put together a company called Integrated Diagnostics that just got funded, and we think it'll be a platform company for using these strategies to create a baseline for many things you can do in personalized medicine. Let me just say that every single informational molecule is potentially a diagnostic, and we could talk about each of these. But three that we're really excited about are microRNAs, proteins you've heard about, and single-cell analyses, and I'll say more about these. I think those are the three molecular informational entities that will really pave the way for P4 medicine. So let me talk about five different kinds of technologies. And these are emerging technologies, but every single one of them has already been applied at some level on patients. So I would argue P4 medicine is medicine of today as well as medicine of the future. So we'll talk in turn about those things. We recently have sequenced the complete genomes from individuals of a family of four, and I think these studies are going to transform how all genome studies are going to be done in the future, because doing them in families gives us the ability to use the Mendelian principles of genetics to do incredible noise correction processes that let us see much clearer detail the anatomical features of the genome, as well as find things like disease genes. And I'll illustrate each of those things. So the sequencing was done by Complete Genomics, a company in the Bay Area that has a terrific, highly automated technology and probably the cheapest prices to date for doing genome analyses. We're in the process of doing, for example, 100 additional genome sequences on families at $12,000 a piece, just to put it in scale. It's a collaboration then between ISB, the University of Utah, and the University of Washington. The family we chose was really interesting because they're of European descent, Caucasian. The two parents were unaffected. The two kids each had two different genetic diseases. One, a congenital face malformation called Miller syndrome, and the second, a cystic fibrosis-like lung disease. So really unfortunate genetic lottery, quite obviously. We got more than 120 gigabases of data for each of these patients, and that gave us somewhere between 80 and 90% coverage. Almost all the coverage that we're failing is in repetitive sequences. We've covered 92 or 93% of the exonic sequences in all of the individuals. Now, the advantages of sequencing a family of four are low error rate, and we'll talk about why that is in just a moment. It's an order of magnitude better than what the Genome Project initially proposed for the first sequence that was done. We've discovered lots of new SNPs and lots of old SNPs. We can now, for the first time, have really detailed recombinational maps of the kids in terms of the recombinational events that have changed their parental haplotypes. We can begin to calculate intergenerational mutation rates. And finally, we've narrowed down these disease gene candidates from 25,000 to 3. And I'll show you exactly how we've done that. So, and basically, the noise suppression comes really from Mendelian genetics. You know what the haplotypes of the parents are, and from that you can deduce what the haplotypes of the children must be, or you can do it the converse way. That is, Mendelian genetics says that there is a certain, certain possibilities are only are present at particular sites. So we can essentially throw out as errors anything that is non-Mendelian in its inheritance. But more than that, these data give us the ability to define large blocks of sequence that compose the parental chromosomes that get passed on to the kids. Hence, in the middle of those blocks, if you have mutations that seemingly have occurred in general, they're going to be incorrect calls. Or if you have lots of calls that haven't been made, you can look to the parental type and make the calls. Now, finally, we were able very easily to find the genes that encode those two diseases. And the assumptions we made were the following. These are really rare genetic diseases. Hence, we think they're going to be encoded by rare alleles that probably haven't been previously defined. Two, non-synonymous changes are required to modify the coding protein region, so we're only going to look at non-synonymous or termination region changes. And then finally, we can test two models, either that of a simple heterozygous, where the disease has from the mother and father exactly the same defective gene, or we can test the idea of compound heterozygotes, that is, the mother and father each gave defective alleles for the same gene, but the alleles are different one from another. And it turned out that a collaboration we had with other people looking at Miller's gene confirmed this was indeed the Miller's gene candidate. And there's some argument about which of the two is the which of these two, although it's agreed it is one of those two, or maybe it's both of those two, caused the cystic fibrosis gene. So this is really remarkable. In one family, we did an analysis that unequivocally gave us excellent candidates for two different genetic diseases. So we think that individual genome sequencing. And in fact, if it says something about going to 23andMe and Navigenics, do it on a family basis rather than just by yourself. You'll learn infinitely more about what you're really about. A second technology is this MRM mass spectrometry for organ-specific proteins. We've already discussed that. A third technology, a collaboration with Jim Heath at Caltech, is a microfluidic protein chip that has the ability to take 300 nanoliters of blood, separate cells from plasma, and then run over 35 assays now the plasma, so you can quantitate 35 different proteins down at the atomal level, the high atomal level, and do it in 5 minutes with a very good dynamic range. And we've actually already put these protein chips in the clinic at UCLA studying the drug responses to patients being treated for melanoma and glioblastoma, and it works beautifully because it's a little pinprick and you can make multiple measurements as quickly as you want to do the dynamics of how the relevant proteins change in this context. One of the questions, of course, is if it is high atomol sensitivity, how can we see the organ-specific proteins from very small organs like the beta cells of the pancreas, which cause diabetes? They're present at a million out of 10 to the 14th cells in the human body. And what Jim has been working on more recently, basically, is using gold particles with the second antibody in the ELISA assay to be able to beautifully actually indicate identify individual protein molecules. And you can think about microfluidic configurations where you can look then at molecules that are present in very low levels in the blood. The limitation of these protein capture agents, of course, of the antibodies, is that we the 35 assays we're measuring on the chip now are basically those that are commercially available, with a few exceptions that we've generated. But to generate the pairs of antibodies that are necessary for ELISA assays is really expensive and takes a long time. So Jim Heath, again at Caltech, has really pioneered a very interesting new approach to capture agents, where he's created a peptide library of six MERS, 10 to the 15th, each placed on beads, synthesized from D amino acids, and in some cases they're branched. And he can then use the protein you'd like to create capture agents for as a selective agent to pick out low affinity monomeric binders. And then you can couple together pairs of those binders that bind at different sites through a chemistry called click chemistry, such that they have the right three-dimensional orientation to create then dimeric protein capture agents, or even trimeric protein capture agents. And with each additional monomer you add, you get more than two orders of magnitude increase in sensitivity. So you can, by the time you get to trimers, make protein capture agents that have every bit the specificity of the best antibodies. What is great about these reagents is they're rock stable. Jim did the experiment of putting one of these reagents in the trunk of his car and leaving it all summer in Pasadena in the trunk, and then at the end in September measured the affinity to show that it was unchanged. So these reagents will really be terrific for the third world. And of course, he's in the process now of trying to parallelize this process and make it into a high-throughput production process so you can generate, we hope to be able to generate in the next 5 years, 2,500 protein capture agents for organ-specific proteins. That is 50 proteins from each of the 50 major organs in human beings. So single-cell analyses, I'm not going to go into the details I see from the program. Many of you are thinking about a lot of the same kinds of things. But what I will say is I think within 2 to 3 years, we'll be able to do all of these things. Complete genome analyses from one cell. Steve Quake has already done this from a microbial cell, and we're talking about doing it from a selected series of cancer cells from and normal cells from single individuals. Complete transcriptomes, complete microRNAomes, and then at lower levels, proteomes and interaction measurements and localization and so forth. And of course, one of the really interesting ideas that we're very excited about is the idea that we could multiplex together 1,000 different transcriptomes from 1,000 different cells barcoding each so that you could pool these together and run them in a single run on the next generation sequencing instrument, and in a single run generate 1,000 transcriptomes. So you can do the dynamics of physiology or development, or you can do disease stratification of cell types and so forth. So let me argue that within 5 years or much less in some cases, we'll be doing the following routine measurements on patients. One, complete individual genome sequences. My prediction is within 5 years we'll be well under $1,000 for individual human genome sequences at high accuracy. Number two, I think we'll be able to do individual cell genome sequences. And that can really be interesting in, for example, studying aspects of cancer and so forth. Number three, as I mentioned earlier, we'll be able to do 1,000 transcriptomes from 1,000 cells simultaneously in one sequencing run, and do look at development, look at physiologic responses, and or stratify disease. We think in 5 to 10 years we'll be able to do 25 organ-specific protein measurements from each of the 50 from each of the 50 organs, and that's going to be an important wellness assessment. We're playing now with methods where we can take 10,000 T and 10,000 B cells and characterize the junctional diversity for their receptors and correlate then that diversity and chain pairing with previous immunologic history, with present immunologic readiness. And of course, this will be a wonderful assay for assessing response to vaccines and things like that. And I think one of the most interesting ideas is that we really want to be able to analyze individual iPS cells that are generated from each individual in a very large study I'm going to be talking about in a few moments. And we're working with a company called Cellular Dynamics to actually be able to convert nucleated blood cells into iPS cells. And of course, the idea is once you've done that, then for the patient and or for the family, you can differentiate those iPS cells to disease-relevant tissues and cell types, and then interrogate them in vitro with regard to molecular and imaging kinds of properties. We think these organ-specific blood fingerprints are really going to transform biology in many ways. The disease diagnostics we've already covered. We've already set up some fascinating studies in a mouse model system, a set of phenomenon toxicity, to show how multiple organs interact with that drug toxin and give really fascinating integrated kind of responses. So for the first time, we can really begin to think about an integrated approach to physiologic responses, whether it's normal development, physiologic responses, or toxins of the sort that we've talked here. Again, the identification of these disease-perturbed networks is going to be absolutely critical as a prelude to this new approach to drug target identification. And these organ-specific blood proteins, in a sense, may be the first frontier in beginning to specify where you go, which networks in which you will search for appropriate kinds of drug candidates, drug target candidates, particularly if you have the dynamics of their activation during the disease process. Assessing the use of drugs in individuals, whether it's clinical trials or personalized medicine, is going to work beautifully. Assess the orthology of animal models to human disease. Because of the enormous orthology of these organ-specific fingerprints, we can say this animal model really resembles this human disease, or more important, it resembles it fantastically in this particular phase, so let's just consider that. A wellness assessment, longitudinal gathering on individuals and so forth, and of course, just assessing human biology as individuals develop, age, or whatever. So I'd argue that, again, there are two things that are driving us to the P4 medicine. One is this systems view of medicine, of disease, and the other are these emerging technologies and their allied necessary computational technologies. Let me tell you that the sequencing of those four individuals probably took about 6 weeks. The data analysis has probably taken us 4 months so far. Now we've put in place pipelines, so when we move to 100, we'll be able to deal with it better. But there are enormous computational problems and challenges in this new medicine. So what about predictive? Well, in the future, we'll have genome sequences, and from those, we'll be able to make probabilistic estimates about future health histories. And even more important, you'll set up early in your lifetime a logic for how you can deal with your potential diseases, an individual assessment of how that will be done. And of course, we'll follow longitudinally the organ-specific blood fingerprints, say on a biannual basis, and I'll bet we'll have little handheld devices that'll prick your thumb, make the measurements, send them to a server, and get back an email. You and your physician, you're fine, do it again in 6 months or whatever. And of course, we can do allied in vivo molecular analyses to look at anything that comes up with regard to the in vitro analyses and so forth. Personalized is really interesting. I mean, we all differ by 6 million letters on average of the DNA language from one another. We're genetically diverse. And that means that each of us has to be our own control for whether we're in a health state or in a disease state. And I never understood from the earliest days of being in medical school how you could do averages of very diverse, genetically diverse human beings and say you're average or you're not average based on statistical analyses of populations. It doesn't really mean anything. You've got to look at what you individually are all about. And there are two points that I think are really important here. In 10 years, we'll have billions of data points on every single individual, and we'll be able to explore the dimensionality of health space and disease space in ways we can't even imagine now. That is the essence of what's really going to be transformational. But even more important, in 10 years, we may have tens to hundreds of millions of individual patients, each with billions of data points. And if we can aggregate and begin to make correlations of what each patient is saying about health and disease, then we will bootstrap and create the future predictive medicine. And what is terrifying to many of us is that we will create health silos where data A won't be available and or is inappropriately mergeable because of standards and a whole variety of other things. That's an issue I'll return to again later on. Preventive has to do with using networks to identify disease targets. And I mean, and what's interesting is you can think about that in terms of therapy, but suppose your genome predicts you'll have an 80% chance of ovarian cancer by the time you're 60, and we know the networks that are going to be activated in that process. Would it be possible to make preventive drugs that could prevent those networks from ever becoming disease perturbed? And I have a feeling it would. And then, of course, using systems approaches to understand the immune response and how to make vaccines properly. I mean, you know, we've spent billions of dollars in the black hole of AIDS vaccines, and all these drug companies have done it essentially the same way Jenner did in 1796. So maybe it's time, and this is what I argued with Tony Fauci 10 years ago, spend the money on a systems approach to immunity, figure out how to make vaccines, and then spend the money on the vaccines. But we're 0 for whatever number it is so far. And of course, the real transition is going to be from a focus on disease to a focus on wellness. And the participatory has to do with how do we teach patients as to what this medicine is and the kind of responsibilities they're going to have for their own health choices in the future. And how are we going to deal with physicians that don't really understand this new medicine, and how are we going to train them, and indeed, how are we going to deal with a medical community that needs to be interconnected and educated? That is the participatory component. I'll make 2 points about P4 medicine and its impact on society. Point one is, I think it's going to transform necessarily in a radical way the business plans of every single sector of the healthcare economy. And some companies will be able to adapt to that and some won't. And I think there's going to be fundamental new economic opportunities to create companies that will be young and agile and oriented toward the real opportunities of the future. Again, it's this idea that old organizations have real trouble adapting to new kinds of ideas. And the second point is, I think we're moving toward the same kind of digitalization of medicine that we saw in communications and information technology, the ability to get disease-relevant information from one molecule, one cell, one organ, any of the units of biological information. And the implications are the same, just as with IT and health and communications. The cost, I think, of medicine will come down enormously. We'll reach a point in the future where there will be a break in the ever-escalating costs. And I think it'll come down to the point where we can export medicine to the developing world, and it'll be the basis for current global medicine. And we can discuss that, obviously, in some detail. This has led ISB to think about strategic partnerships that can accelerate and hasten the time point when that break in P4 medicine actually occurs. And let me tell you about two of the partnerships that we have generated. One is with the country of Luxembourg. They were interested, the Minister of Economy was interested in transforming his economy from a 90% dependence on healthcare to something else. They had a study done, and biotech healthcare was the suggestion. So he put a call out to his counterparts in the U.S. and said, why don't you identify some institutes that might be helpful in this transition? And we were asked, and we volunteered to do the following three things. One, create a center fashioned after our own in Luxembourg at the University of Luxembourg, and we're well into this and have just hired a marvelous director. I think he's one of the best guys we could have gotten in all of Europe. Number two, we suggested that we would do two collaborative research projects that lie at the heart of P4 medicine and bring to ISB $100 million over the next 5 years for doing these projects. And then three, we're helping them establish a biotech industry. And indeed, Luxembourg has indirectly invested a substantial amount in this new company called Integrated Diagnostics. And the two projects have to do with the analysis of thousands of individual genomes from families, both normal and diseased. And I'll talk about the diseased in just a moment. And the first four we did are an example of the power of what this is going to give us. But this will allow us then to develop the tools that will permit us to decipher the digital information of the genome. And of course, what we'd really like to do is understand how that impacts with the environmental information through dynamical network behavior to give you health and disease. And of course, the phenotypic readouts that we can take to begin deciphering these networks have to do with tissue and blood protein messenger analyses. And we're going to be taking stem cells from each of these individual patients for reasons that I've already indicated. And the idea is, once you have the dynamical nature of the networks that respond to these signals, you actually can begin to disambiguate the environmental and the genome contributions. And this is a whole new field of genetics called systems genetics, and that would be an interesting thing to talk about sometime in the future. We're going to study three organs, brain, liver, and lung. We're studying the common diseases in each of those organs. In all cases, we're using animal models because we think you need that to get the dynamics of the networks and deal with the signal-to-noise issues, and we're doing all of the kinds of analyses that I've talked about throughout the course of this lecture, and we're developing, obviously, relevant technologies. And ultimately, again, we want to integrate the data into predictive and actionable models. The second strategic partnership is with Ohio State University. It's to create a nonprofit institute whose task is to solve both the technical barriers to P4 medicine and, in a coordinated way, the societal barriers that can block the realization of P4 medicine. And we're going to do it, one, through the demonstration of pilot projects with killer applications. Number two, okay, I'll finish up. Number two, we're going to bring in a whole series of industries to do this, and I'd be glad to talk about how we're going to go about doing that. So in the interest of time, I'll leave out the interesting points, but let me end then with four assertions. I've made them all. It's just to remind you of them all, so you don't have to worry. P4 medicine is medicine of the present and future. It's going to be effective and inexpensive in the future, not only because of this digitalization I talked about, but our ability to stratify disease and new approaches to drug discovery and wellness and so forth. It's going to replace the old reactive medicine, and I don't think it's going to be incremental. I think it'll be dramatic and transformational, and I think we'll do it through pilot projects such as with Ohio State, where they have 55,000 patients, and they are the payer provider for the patients, and they've agreed to use a lot of the technologies that we've talked about here already. And I think the healthcare debate going forward should be centered around a vision of P4 medicine rather than the old reactive medicine, and I think that's one of the big mistakes the Obama administration has actually made. And I think I've really mentioned most of my colleagues here, so with that, thank you very much.
What is systems biology? We all think we know what it is. There was a benchmark study done, paid for by the U.S. government, by the W Tech Corporation in 2005. They came up with the conclusion that, or the consensus, that systems biology was the understanding of biological network behavior through the application of modeling and simulation tightly linked to experiment. The systems biology efforts at UCSB are wide-ranging. They encompass systems and computation, which is where I come from, so most of this talk is going to be centered around those topics of network identification, robustness and fragility analysis of networks, stochastic simulation, and bioinformatics. We work very closely together with the people who do experiments and invent new technologies for flow cytometry, cell sorting, single cell assays, and bioimaging. And of course, we work very closely together in almost a very tightly knit feedback loop with the biologists who do things like microRNA regulation in tumor cells, circadian rhythm gene networks, heat shock response, unfolded response, papillae phase variation, which is going to be one of the talks this morning, novel biomarkers for diabetes, apoptosis, pathogens, human immune system. We do a lot of different things. Okay, so my view of computational systems biology is that it's a feedback loop. Okay, we work in close cooperation with experimentalists to make a better model and a better understanding with the ultimate goal of targets, therapies, and vaccines. The systems biology enterprise at UCSB goes virtually from the genome to ecosystems. And one of the talks this morning is going to be about ecosystems, in fact. Okay, so I want to start by talking about some of the simulation capabilities that we have here. And there, I would say that we're really extremely strong in the area of simulation capabilities, and probably definitely world class. So first, we have extensive capabilities for data analysis and data mining. And this little icon here is a poster. I don't know if you see. It means there's a poster there, and there's a thumbs up, which means you're supposed to go to that poster if you so desire. Okay, so in the area of dynamic simulation, we can do almost anything imaginable. Deterministic simulation, we do ordinary differential equation models, differential algebraic equation models. Those are ODEs with constraints. That's actually one of the things that I'm known for. Partial differential equation models. We also do discrete stochastic and multi-scale simulation. We are one of the lead groups in the world on stochastic simulation algorithm. We work with the inventor of that algorithm, Dan Gillespie. That's probably the gold standard algorithm in computational systems biology. We have done a lot of work on accelerated and high-performance stochastic simulation algorithms. We even have this running on NVIDIA's general-purpose graphics unit, GPU chip, and getting 200 times the speed of your workstation for about $300. We do another way to do this problem is by moment closure technique. There's a poster on that. There's a totally different way to do this problem that's based on solving the chemical master equation, the equation that governs the dynamics of the time-dependent dynamics of the probability distributions of every chemical species in the system. That's called the finite state projection algorithm. Finite state projection algorithm and SSA are probably the two algorithms that are most widely used now for stochastic simulation in systems biology, and FSP was invented here by Professor Mustafa Kamash. And Kamash and I have recently collaborated to do stochastic simulation in space, so stochastic reaction diffusion systems. We'll talk a fair amount about applications involving that in a few minutes. The new algorithm is called the diffusive FSP method, DFSP. There's a poster about that. My personal feeling about algorithm development is that in order to have an impact, you need to develop software. And so, you know, I have learned years ago that you're not supposed to do this. You're not supposed to crowd your view graph and put something, vertically out on the left side. But there was no other space, and I think this is really important. So this is about our StokeKit solver. It's a stochastic simulation tool kit. And you can just grab it off the web. And a really much better version 2 StokeKit should be available in about 2 months. Okay, so you might be asking yourself, why discrete stochastic simulation? Why don't we just use ODE and PDE models to simulate everything? And the problem is that an ODE model cannot capture effects due to small numbers of key chemical species. And on the other hand, if you drill down scale-wise, you could go all the way down to molecular dynamics model, but that would be too slow given the model complexity and the time scales of interest. So that's why we do discrete stochastic simulation. By itself, it could be very, very slow, even on very fast computers. And that's why all the effort to speed it up, both via hardware and via mathematics, faster algorithms, and multi-scale algorithms, algorithms that combine the best features of ordinary differential equations. So use ODE or PDE models for part of the system when it's mathematically justifiable, and stochastic system for the other parts. Now, lately we've been delving into something much more complicated, spatial stochastic simulation. So this is like moving discrete stochastic simulation from, it's like doing what happened when ODE models turned into PDE models a long time ago. It's taking into account spatial variation, and in biology this would be the effects of spatial localization. After all, a cell is certainly not a well-mixed environment. And down here are two pictures of problems that I'll talk about in a few minutes that involve extensive spatial localization. This first one has to do with unfolded protein response in the endoplasmic reticulum. And this is a photo of fluorescence of some key chemical species that are co-localized on the endoplasmic reticulum. Hence, their environment is much different than species that are hanging out over here in the lumen. This second picture has to do with cell polarization in yeast mating and how the yeasts grow a shmoo and then a polarisome that are directed in the direction of the potential mate. And it's a very heterogeneous process. Lots of chemical species are directed to the location of the polarisome in a very spatially dependent process. Okay, the other things that we're very good at here are model development, analysis, and identification. We have extensive capabilities for sensitivity analysis, which is the tool that helps you in model development to decide whether a certain reaction or a certain result parameter is important enough to go after experimentally. It might be that the system doesn't depend on it very much and we don't need to know it very accurately. On the other hand, it can help you to identify those points where the system could be perturbed, say, by a drug, in order to get a certain desired effect. We can do deterministic sensitivity analysis, so ODE or PDE sensitivity analysis, or even stochastic sensitivity analysis, and there's a poster that talks about this. Other thing we can do is robustness analysis. I'll talk about that in a second. There's a poster that deals with that. And model identification. In other words, if you have a lot of experiments, experimental data, then how do you use those data to populate the parameters in a model? And how do you know that you've done a good job? Okay, so robustness analysis, the way we're doing it now is an interesting combination of the information that you can get about variability in the system from stochastic simulation, from low molecule counts, and from heterogeneity in the population. Okay, so if you've got a population and let's say you're looking for drug targets, you've got identified, you know, a number of different drug targets, how can you distinguish those that are more likely to be successful? Well, the drug has to work across the population. Now, we can use simulation, including stochastic simulation, to identify the amount of variability in the chemical species in the population. Okay, and then we can use a technique developed here and resting on the work of John Doyle from Caltech called the structured singular value to discriminate those interventions that will be robust across the variability of the population. Okay. Finally, systems identification. There's never enough data. Even when there's huge amounts of data, there's never enough data for model development. This is my own personal experience. So how could you take the data that you have and turn it into more than you thought it was? Okay, now if you have single cell measurements, for example, from flow cytometry, then you can produce a distribution of data, of population data for your chemical species, instead of a single number like the average, the mean. That is really multiple pieces of information. Think if you even just had the mean and the variance, okay? That's two pieces of data instead of one piece of data. You can use that for model identification, to discriminate between possible models. In other words, you're using the noise to help reveal the network parameters. Okay. So I just did something I don't usually like to do, which is to start with the math. You're all still here, except for a few people who I noticed walked out the door. But okay. So now I want to tell you about some of our projects that are going on, some of our big projects. The first one is an insulin resistance pathway project. It's a joint effort that's been going on for 2 years, organized by Pfizer with UCSB as a major partner, along with MIT, Caltech, University of Massachusetts, and Entelos Corporation. And the idea is to develop models for insulin resistance pathways in adipose tissue, and it's a huge project with data and with the idea of identifying drug targets. A new project that we have here is on understanding the basis of the chemical basis of post-traumatic stress disorder. You can imagine who's interested in that, the U.S. Army. At UCSB, Frank Doyle and I are working on that project, along with the Walter Reed Army Information Research Institute for Research. This isn't, Anyway, the researchers at Walter Reed, who is Marty Jett, at UC San Francisco, we're working with psychiatrist Charlie Marmar, and we're working with the Institute for Systems Biology, Lee Hood, who you just heard. The aims of this project are to identify early markers of post-traumatic stress disorder and to find diagnostic, preventative, and therapeutic targets of PTSD. This is not a very well understood disease at the biochemical level. A lot of effort is going into data collection and data mining. We're mining the literature to harness new data from genomics and post-genomics studies. We've got human samples for military post-traumatic stress disorder. We've got human stress individual biomarkers, mouse models. Oh, this is a sad thing, stressing out mice. And some archive. The Army has a tremendous collection of archived human samples. And this is a big team that's working together to try to unlock the biochemical basis of PTSD. You might think of PTSD as just veterans coming back, from Iraq or Afghanistan. But it's not only that. If you're in a major accident or some kind of major mental stress, this can also trigger PTSD, and it's actually quite common in the population. A project that's just getting underway or about to get underway, we hope, is coagulopathy. I'm personally very interested and involved in this one. We're working with the Army, the Institute for Surgical Research, and San Antonio, Texas, again with Walter Reed. We're working with the University of Vermont Medical School Professor Dr. Ken Mann, one of the world's leading experts in coagulopathy. We have partners at MIT and Cornell. At UCSB, the team consists of Galen Stuckey and Tom So on the experimental side. They're doing microfluidic devices so that we can study blood as it's actually flowing. And on the computational modeling side, it's me and Frank Doyle. Okay, cell polarization of yeast mating. The students love this project. It's got a coolness factor. At UCSB, this is Professor Mustafa Kamash and myself. We're collaborating at UC Irvine with Professor Tomu Yi. And as I mentioned before, what's going on here is that you've got a bunch of yeast cells. They sense tiny little gradients, pheromone gradients, okay? And when they do, they, if all is working correctly, they start forming a shmoo, a kind of an appendage, and at the tip of the shmoo is the what's called the polarisome. The polarisome points at the potential mate, so they move together in this way. There are many interesting problems sensing the gradient, which is a very weak gradient, and then pulling all of the requisite proteins into position to form the shmoo and the polarisome. It's a highly heterogeneous process. It can go wrong. On this side, we have a mutant yeast, which is forming multiple polarisomes. It's stochastic and spatially heterogeneous. In order to do the spatial stochastic simulation, we've had to develop a new algorithm, and that algorithm is at least an order of magnitude faster, and also for the first time that I know of in such a spatial stochastic algorithm, parallelizable. This whole effort is explained in much more detail in a poster. Okay. As I mentioned before, we're studying protein interactions in the endoplasmic reticulum of yeast. At UCSB, this is Frank Doyle and myself. We're collaborating with Ann Robinson at the University of Delaware. The endoplasmic reticulum is the gatekeeper for the nucleus. It's a very interesting organ, and spatial localization plays a very important role. In fact, space plays a very important role. When the system gets stressed out by too many unfolded proteins, the ER, in a desperate attempt to increase its surface area, becomes, I don't know how well you can see this, but it takes on some very strange shapes, almost fractal shapes. And we believe that these shapes are very important, okay? It's changing, you know, localization on the membrane. Oh, something happened here. Yeah. And here you can see this picture I showed you before where we see localization of key chemical species on the membrane. We're building a spatial stochastic simulator to deal with these highly irregular geometries. Okay, and finally, and I could go on and on. This talk could be, good thing that it's not, but this talk could be at least, it could go on for hours. I've only selected, you know, projects where I'm comfortable talking about. So there's many other projects going on, and if for my UCSB colleagues who are in the audience, please don't feel left out if you were left out. The last project I'll talk about is modeling inflammation in cerebral ischemia. This is a joint project between UCSB, Mustafa Kamash, and Stanford, the Gifford Lab. And the motivation is that ischemia is the disruption of blood flow after a stroke initiates a vastly complex response in the brain. Of course, we would like to understand that. The critical inflammatory pathway is the NF-kappa B activation pathway. So in this project, they're making a big effort to understand that pathway, to develop a mathematical model to capture the dynamics of the NF-kappa B activation, to understand the mechanism of heat shock protein 72 modulation of ischemia, and to identify potential therapies.
On PTSD, I'm just wondering what sort of data is available, human data, animal models, you know, what do you really find that you have to base your models on?
This project is just getting started, and Frank knows more about it than I do, but there are multiple sources of human data. There are archives that the Army has, but of course they have in an archive, they haven't always gotten exactly the data that you'd wish for, because they didn't maybe anticipate this particular project. There are, from the Veterans Hospital in San Francisco, Charlie Marmar is planning to get samples from the military patients. And we also have are producing mouse data.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.